The 8th World Congress of Pediatric Cardiology and Cardiac Surgery will take place in the United States for the first time in 38 years in Washington, D.C. between August 27th and September 1st, 2023. There are 22 interdisciplinary tracks. There will be about 4,000 to 5,000 people. It's an opportunity for you to meet people you work with, either directly or collaboratively from all over the world, and that we hope to see in Washington, D.C.
Hey guys. Welcome back to the Selfie Show. It's Tori.
And Sam.
Two besties bring you all things healthcare, humor.
And unpopular opinions.
What's going on?
I mean, this year it's like you close your eyes for 2 days and everything's always something new, something changed. Like, what the hell? I cannot keep up.
I know. Literally, this week was popping.
Yes.
It's a showdown.
Unpopular opinion. I don't know. Is this popular or unpopular? Like, because I don't know where people are at.
Okay, yeah.
With thread.
Here we go. Are we threading?
I like it.
I'm threading. I'm
like,
here for it.
I was number 10, user 10 million something.
I'm like user 81 million because I was on the slow train and I had to come up for air because I've just been in a black hole. But like, holy smokes, like, Threads is popping, though. It is absolutely unhinged. It is hilarious.
Okay, so I had Twitter in 2011, and it was unhinged. Yeah. I think my account's still active, and it's private, thank God. So if you want to look me up, you can't. It's private, which is good, because all of my drunk tweets from 2011 when I was in nursing school.
Love that for you.
All private. But I was unhinged. My name was The Saucy Minx, by the way.
That
was,
love that for you.
That was literally my MySpace name and my Twitter name back in, 2009
through
2011, whatever. But bro,
yeah,
I used to just like drunk tweet unhinged shit. And I feel like that energy is back and I love it. Like, people are saying things that they would never post on their stories. Or,
oh my God,
Instagram.
I know.
Like,
I love this.
Whoomst are you?
Whoomst are you? What is going on? So Meta is finally having its moment with the Twitter alternative Threads. With 100 million users, Mark Zuckerberg is already winning his fight against Elon Musk, at least in the cage match that is social media. I cannot believe 100 million people
already.
Bro,
that is wild.
Wild.
That's better than Zuckerberg thought. So my first thread I wrote was like, I'm only here because I think Elon Musk is a tool. And I think a lot of us are here just because we hate Elon Musk.
But it's like, okay.
I'm conflicted because I hate Zuckerberg. I hate Facebook. I hate Meta. I hate that Instagram is part of Meta, but it is what it is. But I'm like, which one do I hate more?
Right. Like,
probably
the lesser
Elon.
Of evils.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what are we choosing?
But I hate that I'm making one billionaire rich just to screw another billionaire.
I know. It's funny, too.
I wish there was a startup.
Like, I had a Twitter, but honestly, I never went on it. And I felt like it was a cesspool even like back in the day. And so like, but now here I am, I'm threading and I'm kind of liking it. I also was really confused. Literally, my first thread was like, I'm confused. Is the feed the same as your search explore page? I'm like, this is just hilarious. But I don't know. I'm kind of here for it.
I think there's kinks, but yeah. I think it's clean. Like, aesthetically, it's so much cleaner. The black and white, I think, is super clean.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that it's tied to your Instagram because you immediately are connected with
people. Yeah, I kind of do too.
But then I kind of don't, because there's some people where I'm like, I just accidentally did the follow all and I'm like, oh.
Me too.
Meh.
But I kind of like feel like that's kind of the thing, is like, if everybody follows everybody, that's like kind of, it seems like what seems like everybody's doing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I just did
it. The growth is already there. You don't have to like start from zero.
I just followed everybody that I'm like, here we go. I'm going to give you a follow because why not? But I like how it is, too. It's nice and clean. I feel like it's hilarious. People there, I feel like, are bringing out a lot more personality than I ever would have thought.
Yeah.
The only thing that's interesting, and you brought this up.
No, we got duped.
Because if you want to delete your threads, you have to delete your entire Instagram. Mm-hmm.
I saw someone thread that. They posted a picture and they said, man, they got us. This is what happens when we don't read terms. And it was like, delete account. And it showed the options. And it said, either delete individual, you can go back and delete all your individual threads, but if you want to delete your whole account, you have to delete your Instagram. And I'm like,
that's crazy.
That's a little sus.
It's a little sus.
But they do that with Meta, like, to delete Facebook. I don't have Facebook, but I'm still
active
on Messenger.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, I can't, because actually I just deactivated Facebook. I don't want to ever completely delete it because I have old pictures from there from Europe in 2010.
Yeah. Right.
That I, if I want to log back in and get them, I can, but I don't. But to get off Messenger, well, I have to delete, like fully delete my account. I'm like, why?
Yeah. Even they make it really hard to undo things. Like, it's funny because even on my, on Instagram, so we have the shop attached to my thing and it's impossible to get it off of there. Like, I wanted to get it off. And I'm like, it's just things like that, that Facebook and Meta, they make it so hard to undo. And it is funny because so many things nowadays are linked to our Facebook accounts or like somehow linked to Meta in some way. Mm-hmm. So it's like they force you to almost have one, which is really frustrating. But I don't know. Threads, I'm kind of here for it. It's unhinged. And I honestly, we're all in it now together anyway. So here we are.
I would like nothing more to see Elon Musk fail. But I still hate Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, but I like just seeing, like the battle that is, I love watching the battle.
I just like seeing two billionaires go fight at it in general. That's fun.
It's hilarious.
I wanted the cage match fight, to be honest.
I know. Was that, it's not happening, is it?
No.
Did it get canceled? Damn.
Who would you have put money on? Like in an actual like cage match fight of Musk.
Okay. So I feel like initially, honestly, Elon probably would have gotten the first round or two, but then I think he would have tired out, you know? Something about that to me.
He's older, definitely.
He gives me a little more like heart attack-y vibes, you know?
He looks like he probably like does steroids and more, but like I feel like Zuckerberg probably is like some black belt in karate that we don't know about, you know what I mean? Like
100%.
Probably, like,
he's got
he would probably like shut it down in like the first round.
Or he's like one of those bikers, you know, like the, you know, endurance bikers, like for sure, you know? I just feel like low-key there's something about that. I don't know. I think Elon would have come out, you know, swinging real hard, but then would have lost it in the, the second half.
You know? I want to see everyone's most absolute just unhinged behavior, though.
Oh my God,
so
I know.
And
I can't
thank you.
It's been actually, and I love that because it is really bringing that out of people and I love it. Mm-hmm. That's not where I anticipated it going, but you know what? I'm here for the most like unhinged, unperfect, beautiful.
It's made
moments.
Me like some people a little bit more than
for
I thought.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. Love that for us.
One of the best episodes.
Oh my gosh.
So good.
This was by far, I don't know, this was like a deep moment with like, he's going to love that we referred to him as like our uncle. I don't know. Or like someone that you just really
this is like
love
everyone's life mentor.
For sure.
After this episode, this is your new like wise mentor that you just want to like.
You want to have a gill in your pocket. Yes. You know what I mean? Like he's like the guy that you just, he's very wise. Wise beyond his years, but then hilarious. So we love this combination.
Also, just a man of very many hidden talents. So today we have on Dr. Wernofsky. He's a pediatric cardiologist and intensivist specializing in cardiac critical care. He graduated with his BS degree in 1978 in anthropology and music.
Mm-hmm.
Literally musician. Mm-hmm. So rad. It's like it really shaped who he is. So he attended Penn State University College of Medicine and received his MD in 1982, completed his pediatric residency at New York Hospital, which is now known as Cornell. And in 1985, he did his pediatric cardiology fellowship at Boston Children's, finished that in 88, and has been focusing on cardiac intensive care ever since. He started at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in 95 and was the medical director of the first pediatric cardiac intensive care unit in the United
States. Which is insane.
Because we've all modeled after that since then.
And we've worked at them, too.
Gil has been involved in training and mentoring over 300 fellows in pediatric cardiology, cardiac surgery, neonatology, critical care medicine, and cardiac anesthesia. In addition to countless residents and medical students, he's edited 6 textbooks, 13 periodicals. He's published nearly 300 peer-reviewed manuscripts, book chapters, and reviews. He has just an incredible work of like academic research under his belt, and he's been cited over 25,000 times.
Insane. That's, and it's so
such
funny
a flex.
When you guys, when we introduced him, he was so mad at me, but I'm gonna say it, he is the man, the myth, the legend in cardiology. Like, he's absolutely amazing for pediatric cardiology. He's making waves for everyone. He's also the co-chair of upcoming the 8th quadrennial World Congress of Pediatric Cardiology and Cardiac Surgery. This has been planned for many years. He was also awarded the prestigious Newberg Bellinger Award in 2015 for his lifetime contributions to the field of neurodevelopment in children with heart disease. We want to give a very personal note here. So I personally met Dr. Wernoski at Neil Heart last year. I was introduced to him by many of your favorite, Dr. Amir Ashrafi. And I cannot tell you guys how blown away I was by his knowledge, his warmth, his ambition. It was a very brief introduction, honestly, but since then we've developed a really amazing, just this professional, amazing relationship. And these amazing things that he has done have amounted to this one big moment that Sam and I will be going to officially. We wanted to tell you guys up top, we are officially going to the 8th World Congress. It is going to be in August, and we are coming. So we want you guys to come with us. We have the link in the bio for you guys and in the show notes as well. We are thrilled. So I'm most likely going to be there Saturday through at least Tuesday. Sam will be there all week. So we would love to absolutely see you guys there. Again, the link is there in the bio for you. We are so thankful to have Dr. Gill on today and to have on this man with such amazing passion to change lives and improve medical team dynamics. And trust me, you guys, buckle up. You are in for an amazing episode.
This is an honor for me, and thanks for the kind words. I really do appreciate it. It's, you know what? I read some of the notes that we were going to talk about. And first of all, you better have changed the name of this podcast. That's the first thing.
Okay, That's the
funniest email we've ever received.
I know. I put the man, the myth, the legend, because you really are. And he was like, you better change the name of this episode. And I was like, all right, we'll go back to the drawing board. But it is true. Okay. You're a legend.
So was Achilles. See what happened to his heel? So it just better be something other than that. Like, you'll get to visit with Tori and Sam.
All right. Well, I promise. Well, and I was showing Sam, you know, when we were kind of, you know, reviewing, I was telling her, like, we're going to have to narrow down this intro because
I think it's the longest bio.
The longest, most incredible bio I've ever seen in my life. And okay, so for people who don't know you, yeah, it was
it might be shorter to just be like, okay, this is what he hasn't done. Name one, two things.
I haven't done a podcast, but now I could say I did a podcast.
Correct.
Well, boom. Yeah, you got to add that to your resume now.
Yeah, you do. I want to go back to the beginning, though, because you have such an interesting professional life and career, but this definitely stemmed from somewhere. So for people who don't know you, let's get some context of a little bit more of your upbringing. You're from Philly, but I want to get a little bit more of the younger
East. Well, just to put it in perspective, so I'm classic boomer. I was born in 1956. I didn't have a seatbelt. My parents smoked. I ate Swanson TV dinners. And peas out of a can, right? So
those are good.
So I was about as Northeast Philly as you could get. So I grew up in the Northeast in a row house, which is basically 20 houses connected. All the walls are all contiguous with each other. You know, sort of a lower middle class area of Northeast Philly. But my parents were really diehard on getting me two things that was non-negotiable. One was education. And a career, not a job. They said that all the time. You want a career and not a job. I didn't know it, you know, 12, what do I know? And they forced me to continue my instrument when I did not want to. And there's a lot of interweaving of music. I'll tell you a few stories along the way, but there's a lot of interweaving between the music that I do and other things that I've done growing up and how I ended up becoming a physician. So, you know, it's the 70s, it's high school. We're listening to what, you know, you don't know. But, oh, you know what? My first kind, guess what the first concert was that I ever went to?
We might know.
I was born in 56.
The Who? Okay, I'm going Joni Mitchell. I'm going The Who. I'm going,
I knew early on.
I was going to say the Eagles almost.
So,
wow.
Okay. I knew at that point.
You knew, you knew.
It was the most ridiculous experience I ever had. I was 10 years old and, you know, who knew what that would turn into. But my parents were very supportive of doing that. And it was non-negotiable that I continue with my education. So going back to the younger years, so I was in high school in the 70s. It was, I won't get into what I can't get into on the selfie show, but it was.
You can get into everything.
Honestly, whatever you want. You can cuss. You can say whatever you want. We love this for us. So
you can be a true Philadelphian.
You can be.
It was the 70s. And I played a lot of music.
Enough said.
I started to play in a band, and we played Allman Brothers, and we played Eagles, and we played Yes, and, you know, that sort of genre. Then I went, I knew I wanted to do something with a career, but I wasn't exactly sure what it was. I thought I was going to become a vet. And there were only 22 vet schools in the country, very hard to get into.
Still very limited.
I mean, pediatrics is the next best thing, right?
I guess I'll just be a doctor.
I mean, I have.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how I rank things. Animals, then pediatrics, then adults.
My patients can't talk to me, and I have to listen to their owners. It's the same thing as being a vet, right? Anyway, so I thought I was going to be a vet, and I went to a relatively small school in, right outside of Boston called Brandeis University. And I did a couple of things there. I did not go the traditional pre-med route. I was an anthropology major and a music major. And I joined a band, and we cut what was called an EP at the time. It was on vinyl. It was through an 8-track thing. And the day we opened for a jazz guitarist at a club, about 3,000 people, right? I'm 19 years old, 20 years old. The day that we opened for this guy, his name was George Benson. The day we opened for George Benson, I got into medical school. And at that point, I had to sort of make this decision, what am I going to do? And my father, he was never like, you have to do this with me. He gave me a lot of options and whatnot. This is the first time he was really firm. And he said, you can, for all I care, you can play with the Rolling Stones after you get your degree. Get your degree, because you'll never lose that, and you'll always have your music. And of course, I was very torn at that point, but he was right, like he was many, many other times. And if you look at some of the books I've written, the acknowledgments are always thanking my parents for not allowing me to become a musician, because I would not be sitting here talking with you if that was the case. So fast forward, I went to medical school in Penn State. Penn State Medical School is in Hershey. So you wake up in the morning, you smell chocolate. It's just like they say. And my fourth year of medical school, my wife, but my girlfriend at the time lived in Philly, and she had an apartment, and I basically wanted to go stay with her for a month, which in 1981 was not the same as it is now. So I called Children's Hospital of Philadelphia a month before. Like, nobody calls for an elective a month before. I called a month before. And to talk about serendipity, and they said, somebody just dropped out of this rotation. Would you like to do pediatric cardiology? I said, sure. I didn't know. And I basically I basically just wanted to live with my wife. We've just been married for our 41st anniversary. Thank you. Thank you. But at the time, so now I go into pediatric cardiology as a medical student, you know, and you think you know what you're doing. You've met the medical students that probably come in your unit. You know that they're one of two types. They're one, they know it all, or they're deer in the headlights. You never sort of get the in-between medical student. Right, there really isn't.
There's no in-between.
I'm sure that shocks you. And I walked in, and there was this man tinkering with the EKG machine. It was those old EKG machines with a needle, and you would get one lead and all the rest of it. And I'm like, I have to do an EKG stat. I felt very proud of myself that I said stat. And he goes, young man, the only thing you have to do stat is think. And that was, that man fixing the EKG machine was a guy named Bill Rashkin, who invented the Rashkin atrial septostomy. Like, I'm talking to this guy, like, I know what I'm doing. And here's one of the fathers of pediatric cardiology. Wow. And I'm thinking he's with biomedical engineering. Yeah, just another one of these like ego moments where you sort of need to be a little bit humble. And I had some great experiences with that, but I didn't think I was going to be a pediatric cardiologist. I got into my fellowship or my residency at what was called New York Hospital at the time. And that's in Manhattan. It's now called Weill Cornell. And I, you know, did my very first patient, July 3rd as an intern, right? I'm coming up on the anniversary of that. Was a kid that came up from the ER with a calcium of like 15 and was a kid with Williams syndrome and heart disease. My first patient, I should have known. So my first patient as an intern had heart disease. Then I went into the ICU, my first patient had heart disease. Something was steering me in this direction. And I was, we didn't have a match back then. So I was offered a fellowship in Boston Children's and I took that fellowship. And then a whole bunch of other events happened, which led that are also equally coincidental. But I'll stop there and see if there's other questions. So I went basically from the row houses of Philly with a series of events that just seemed to fall into my lap, which has happened all my career. and ended up a fellow at the Premier Children's Hospital, where in the 80s was the place where all the new stuff was done. I'll just say one other thing before I mm-hmm. take a break. Where I ended up as a first year fellow was where the first arterial switches were done, where the first Norwoods were done, where the first pediatric electrophysiologist happened,
wow.
where color Doppler came in, where the first cardiac intensive care unit was. And of course, as a novice fellow, I thought that's the way it's sort of everywhere. So I was exposed to the people right. that led the field 5 years ahead of me. And they were great mentors and great sponsors and really helped me along the way get to where I am now. There's no question that if I didn't take that fellowship again, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here with you. So
we actually all have your wife to thank for that. Because if you didn't just want to
Sam,
be with
Sam
her,
for so many things.
Where you ended up. Does she remind you of that all on the regular? Because I would. I'd be
no,
like,
not on
well,
the regular, but,
actually,
but when I'm not.
You're welcome.
Fairly often. I'll leave it that way. But seriously, I mean,
we love her for that.
What comes to mind, though, is, okay, because Sam and I have done this now. I've been about 10 years. You've been 12-ish?
Yeah.
Okay. And what's so remarkable about you is you have a very unique gift with communication and teaching. And also, there is an element with you that I think is, it's like medical meets almost artistic. Do you feel like, you know, through your journey, do you think that that had an effect on you through your journey? I would argue that it helped you in a lot of ways, like that artistic side of it. But, you know, that kind of, how have you gotten to this amazing person that you are today, where you're leading, you're writing books, you are changing, you know, you are changing lives for children, truly. I mean, I know we like to all write that off, but you really are. But how have you mastered all that?
Thank you again. That's awfully kind. That I'll share just a couple of vignettes that relates to that. So when I interview fellows or staff people or whatnot, I like to find out what kind of sports they do and what kind of music they like. I played Ultimate Frisbee for 35 years at the US level. And for me, being on a team is the most important thing for me to get satisfaction in anything. And isn't that what gets us to where we are today? When I find out somebody's favorite sport is soccer, and this is not a knock on anything, soccer or rugby or baseball or basketball, that speaks to me as a team member. If I interview somebody and they like marathon running, one-on-one tennis, you see the direction that I'm going. Those are people that are singularly focused mm-hmm, right. and will bring a lot to the table. And you have to sort of sort out what type of person are we looking for. I fall in one category. I can't do the other stuff. I am very social, as you can tell. So that's one part of it. When I get to the music part, if you can play in an orchestra or you can play in a band, especially jazz, and hear what's happening around you and respond to that in the way that we do in an intensive care unit in particular, the parallels are uncanny. And for me, as a pop jazz piano player, sports player, intensivist, I see very little difference in the personality type that goes with those three things. I think they're very related.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the discipline it takes to become very good at this, or the interest.
And you can never do it alone.
Right. It takes
Can't
years
do it alone.
Of practice.
Right? There's no way to do what right. we do alone. So there are great, I'll pick something, an office-based pediatric neurologist who will give you the best neuro exam you will ever get, is singularly focused on one patient. A surgeon who might be doing a delicate arterial switch is singularly focused. At that time, there's nothing going on around her or him. Same thing with an anesthesiologist. But if you want to work in an intensive care unit, you've got to be a team player. And so it was natural for me, given what my personality type was, to gravitate to the sports like that, to gravitate to music like that, and to gravitate to the ICU. I thought I was going to be an outpatient pediatric cardiologist. Mm-hmm. And I walked into my fellowship, and there was a cardiologist there named Peter Lang, who was, of many, many people, one of the most primary persons that's responsible for where I am now. He loved what he did, you know? And it wasn't that I liked intensive care, although I did. I said, I want to be like that guy. I want to be as happy as he is coming into work every day. I want to be able to watch him teach and hug a parent when something goes well. And, you know, and like many things, like when I met Bill Raschke, it's not so much for some of us, I don't know how you guys were, but for some of us, it's the science. For some of us, it's the way surfactant works. For some of us, it's that I come in and there's 22 people there that day and we're all going to pull up our bootstraps and get her done.
I think you really touch on just the dynamics of having successful medical teams, because I think no matter which end of the spectrum you're on, nursing, medical, or even some of all the other disciplines that are involved in that ICU setting, it really does take a village. But I think you help kind of model a good way. And I know you're big on training and mentoring new doctors and everything,
and nurses
kind of coming up into this. So I thought it was interesting. And nurse, which honestly, I
Thank
learned,
God.
Like, I know that you and Dr. Ashrafi are close, and he did a great job
favorite.
Of mentoring us as nurses when we worked with him.
He would grab the whiteboard. This is a fun. Back in our day, it was like, let's call 1 a.m. It wasn't midnight because he knew that was care times, but he would come
fact
in.
That he 1 knew, the fact that he knew what time were care times is how you work as a team.
Mm-hmm.
He would stroll in and he'd say, what's up, party people? What are you doing? And then he would
be like, let's talk about pressors.
And then we would say, hey, like, or he would say, let's pick a diagnosis. What is your kid on? And then he'd say, oh, PDA, are we treating it? Are we not? And then why are we treating it here? Why are we not treating it there? You know, it's just that kind of mentality that I think makes a really good team. And he's affected us for the rest of our careers, truly.
Like, and I think it's the modeling good teamwork, because even when you described that one doctor, you're like, I want to be like him. I want to come in and be happy to be at work and be in a good mood and hug parents. And so you now being where you are, what advice do you have for people coming up where they were like, I want to be like Gil? Like, if I was like, Gil, I want to be like you. Like, how do I do that?
Well, I'll tell you the things that make me happy now, you know, 40 years into this. And I think it's that I've really embraced that it's our responsibility, the global our responsibility, to pay it forward. That what I learned, good and bad, like, don't do this. I screwed that up. It's our, so when I walk in and there's a novice nurse who is a little bit, you know, just coming to take their first post-op or whatever it might be, or they're just coming out of school and on orientation, they have to feel like they're supported at every level, because we know that if they stay there for a number of years, not only does that make your unit do better, they're happier, they're having a career, not a job. And that's at every level. So the advice that I would have is that the respect I have for the people who gave me my opportunities and my teaching, I owe it to them to do it to the next generation. That responsibility is there. And if you come into it being humble, I mean, and early on in my career, it was about me. It's like how many times I got on the stage and, you know, oh, look, I have a new line on my CV and all that stuff. And that's normal. I think that's an appropriate sort of attaboy. But as you move forward, it really does become our responsibility to then not take the stage and give the next generation the stage. So that's a long answer, Tori, to the question of, what advice do I have? That's a part one, is that it's not about you. It's about our field and it's about helping other people, most importantly, the baby and their parents. And then I guess the second part is to be open to things that fall in your lap. And I saw one of the questions that we might talk about is the difference in the generations. This sort of lays into it is how to be a good mentee. The notion, what I've seen is the notion of my generation, we were 36 on, 12 off, 36 on, 12 off. It was absurd. It was unsafe. It was stupid. I'm not doing the back in my day. I did this back in my day. I would drive the wrong way down a one-way street because I wasn't paying attention. But what we felt responsible for was if somebody gave us a project, you do it, man. You do it. And you, if something falls in your lap, you do it. The difference I see now, and it's probably healthier for the trainee or the nurse or the doctor or whatever of the so-called work-life balance, and we can even get into that. But if an opportunity falls in your lap, not only do you have to be open to it, but you have to be a good mentee. It's, you know, you can't expect your mentor to just drop something in your lap and then feed you stuff every 2 months to say, you have to do your part. So it's not about you. We have a responsibility to pay for it, and you have to do your part. Balancing that with, you've got kids, you've got a loan to pay, you've got all the other things that are real life, is the challenge in the current generation.
Mm-hmm. I love that you brought that up. That's something that Sam and I have talked a lot about, is in the our generation, let's call it the millennial, your boomer, right? And we're raising our Gen Z coming up. It is an interesting, weird time that we're in, because I personally feel like I am taking a little bit more route of I need to say no to this, but also feeling I really want to continue to give back in my profession. I want to be the best at what I'm doing. And I want to also teach this upcoming amazing generation. We want them to get involved, but then we don't want them burned out. You know, there's a lot of burnout going on, and this is very heavy in nursing right now, right? It's like we see everyone leaving bedside for reasons, and we lived those reasons. We were those reasons. We would work 12 shifts in a row, you know, to try and make those bonuses. And I mean, we did some crazy stuff.
No, I did 15.
Are they 12s or 8s?
I was 12. I never did 15.
You did 15, 12?
12 night shifts.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
We were crazy.
They were giving bonuses.
Yeah, we were like, and we were 20-something. We were 24, 25. You know, we were like living it up.
I also didn't want to take a day off because then I would lose my assignment. You know what I mean? If I had a good assignment, I had a micro preemie that was 2 6-hour cares on drips, was NPO. So I was like, you're critical, but you're stable and you're a one-to-one. If I take one shift off, it's going to get assigned to someone new. And then I'm going to ride this assignment. Not safe. Not
safe. You know, and it is funny because I
did it.
I find myself being in that shoes too, Gil. And I love that you brought this up. Is like, I don't want to be the person that says, this is how we did it. This is what we went through. But then there's that little ting of like, but we went through it. And so like, you know, this is what has built me to be the nurse I am today. So then should...
I think we touch on this a lot when we talk about bullying, where we're like, listen, you gotta toughen up and man up a little bit, but it doesn't mean that some of the things that we experienced were right or okay. And there's a balance in there.
Yeah.
Like doing the 36 hours and stuff, you're like, that's not good. But right. I think the younger generation, they do need to like toughen
still
up a smidge, but it doesn't mean right to the extremes of because we suffered, you have to suffer too. Right. I don't like
I am loving listening to the two of you.
There's a happy middle. There's a happy middle in there.
There is a happy middle.
Because there are people that are just like, well, in my day, and I suffered and I went through this, so you should have to too. It's like, no. I want to leave things better than I found them or what I went through. But I also want to empower people to be them best selves. So there's a
and a
sweet
piece
spot
of a team, right? Yeah. And like want to.
There's so many things going through my head as you're talking about that. But it was, and you're not saying anything that I haven't heard before. What you're experiencing is not unique to Southern California. It's just as common here in DC or Philly. Or
go Eagles, fly Eagles, fly.
It's the same everywhere. It's hard to find a role model that stays at the bedside for 30 years anymore. I mean, that sort of stuff is hard, but I heard a number of things in there, especially Sam, what you were talking about is we all respond to incentives, right? We all get resentful when our expectations are not met. We all want progress, but we're resistant to change, which is a real important thing, which took me a long time to remember about that. And the fact that my generation has to come to give in also, just like the younger generation, as you were saying, quote, toughen up a little bit. that my sense is, in a negative word of entitlement, I don't want to say entitlement, but I said entitlement.
We know what you mean.
No, though, it is a little bit. I taught nursing school for 5 years, and I was getting a little burnout during COVID because I was teaching on Zoom, and I'm like, the entitlement is there, and you guys are having some unreasonable expectations that this is just, like, I would have someone's parent email me. I'm like, this is a university. You are in college to get your bachelor's degree in nursing, and your parent is emailing me.
Yeah.
Or when you go to work, is your parent going to email your employer? And, like, No.
It's hard.
Like,
I mean, it's hard for my generation, for sure, to recognize that things have changed. To me, the biggest two changes across this time has been the internet and cell phones. These things have changed everything. That if you've grown up with those things, you expect things to happen instantly. You want DoorDash? Boom. You got DoorDash. Mm-hmm. You want a movie? I got it on Netflix. You want this fancy microphone you made me buy? Boom. It just came out. I don't know what I can do. But you order that on Amazon, it comes the next day.
I love it.
So the younger generation, that's normal to them. So for me to say that's
right. There's no Blockbuster runs on Friday night trying to figure out arguing over what movie we're doing.
No internet. And to me, if I had to say what are the differences, those two things enabled the different attitudes we see today. Number one, you can find out that what's going on in the intensive care unit in Bozeman, Montana, which to me, when I grew up, did not exist. We competed against each other. Mm-hmm. So you jumped.
Yes. I would argue that was even 10 years ago. I would argue that's recent, that the shifting of more sharing is
social media based.
Yes. Like, almost. It's interesting because I would say 10 years ago, that was still a thing. We were competing. We were competing with other hospitals, with other children's hospitals.
But you kind of have to wait for conferences to come out or actual research studies to actually know what they were doing over there, because the information sharing wasn't instantaneous.
Now, it's like everyone's talking, everyone's, you know, and I love that personally, but
so,
yes, I would agree
so
with
the
you.
Notion, like my first research project, my very first paper, the spreadsheet that I used was I typed it on a typewriter. And every time there was a mistake, I had to get the wipe off stuff. And the spreadsheet was the nursing assignment sheet. It had a lot of grids on it. And that's how, you know, so for me to think, oh my God, I can't believe how easy it is for these kids. Great. Instead of just grumbling about it, we all want progress, but we're resistant to change. So I have to lean into the notion that my students, my fellows, the nurses, should not have to memorize the 5 Jones criteria for rheumatic heart disease. Why memorize that? You need to know how to look them up on your computer in your pocket. So there has to be some give and take from my generation, and the people that are struggling with that, fortunately, are going off into a different profession. And the younger the current people coming out of school doing this for about 5 years have always had that and expect things instantly. I don't mean expect. They're used to things happening quick. So when you can't get something through the IRB for 3 months, it's the IRB's problem, not mine. If you can't get your computer to work very well, it's IT's problem, not mine. If I want something done, I send an email and click send. Now it's not my problem. It's someone else's, not knowing if the email got there or whatever. So if I had to sort of say where part of that challenge is recognizing that people have expectations of rapidity and being given things that my generation never saw. I mean, it took a long time, and you didn't do the work. Well, hell with you. I'll find somebody else who does the work. So these are the clashes, right, that I see. Right. And if the middle gen, what do you guys call millennials? If you guys have an expectation for the younger nurses to do something and they don't meet that expectation, you might become resentful. Whereas the reality is the student the problem, or your expectation is not the right ones to have? Probably somewhere in the middle, right? So these are the clashes that every generation has. I'm sure my parents looked at our generation is, what is that crap you're listening to downstairs? You know, it's like I said to, you know, to something else. So every generation has this. The difference is we're talking about it now. It's being videoed.
The interesting part too is, yeah, well, the other thing too, which I think is interesting, and maybe in the defense of our younger generations and maybe in our generation, is comparatively speaking to your generation, there's so much more on top of the things that you guys had as a base, right? It's like more medications, more technology, more diagnosis, sicker patients, you know, just like we know so much more, there's so much more to add on top of that. So I feel like that's a big factor. I guess my question to you is, what are some of, in terms of cardiology, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in your 39 years? Like,
someone's age.
Yeah. Like, can you even, like, where do you start? You know, like, where do you even start? Right? Where do you even start with that?
Well, you were a co-author. We, Tori, put something in the Neonatology Today, the July issue, where I got a chance to sort of think about that. None of the surgery that we now do, none of the intensive care that we now do would ever have happened without two medical things, which is prostaglandin and echocardiography. I came right at the cusp of that. So prior to around 1982, if you were born with, so the surgeons might have been able to put things together, but they never had a baby that was stable enough to do it. So that was the first step. The second step was echo. Which we all take for granted now, but we went to the cath lab to make a diagnosis with a kid with a pH of 7.2. So those two things set the stage, right?
Yeah.
We could make a diagnosis non-invasively and we could stabilize them. So that then opened up the door to neonatal heart surgery. And that then opened up the door to cardiac intensive care units, which I can talk about another time of the pluses and minuses of those. You're ready to jump in. I can see it. But let me.
Yeah, I'm like,
we're going to go back to that one. I just need to mention those. I was like, we'll be back.
So yes, so there was this boom of neonatal surgery that was made possible by the things that we just talked about. The next biggest medical thing was clearly nitric oxide. The way we dealt with the risk of pulmonary hypertension prior to 1992 was significant hyperventilation, barotrauma, high doses of pressors, you know, things along those lines. So, and we shared a lot of this with the NICU, right? So there was surfactant, we had prostaglandin. There was nitric oxide. There was ECMO in both units. These were the things that laid the groundwork. Mm-hmm. And in my view, there hasn't really been a disruptive change where, like, oh my God, we've never done this before in the past 20 years. Basically, there's not been a new operation. There's been tweaks to what we do. There's been some better medication use. There's been some strategic things, some strategies to get kids extubated. But the real boom in our field is 20 years ago. I'm waiting for the next one. And I've been around long enough to sort of, it's coming, right? Prostin was in the mid-70s. Neonatal heart surgery was the mid-90s. And here we are. We're waiting for it. What's it going to be?
You need something. Yeah. We need something to shush it up. Yeah.
I think what people don't understand is I've worked at a children's hospital my entire career, and I explained to them that we're a children's hospital, but yes, there are adult patients at our children's hospital, and they're like confused. And I'm like, if you work at like a tertiary type children's hospital that has cardiac patients, what you guys don't understand is back in the day, like you said, they used to just die. And now they've gone so far in this world of pediatric cardiology that we've been able to keep patients alive that are now in their 20s, and an adult cardiologist is going to have no idea about their pathophysiology of their cardiac defect and the surgery that they did to. I always joke when I used to teach nursing school and I teach about cardiac defects, I would always tell my nursing students that cardiac surgeons are just fancy plumbers. But I was like, don't ever call them that because they're not going to think it's a funny joke. But I was like, I'm trying to reframe their mind of like, okay, when we go talk about these, what we're really doing is repiping the heart to make it go. Like there's some sort of blockage or it's not pipe. The pipes aren't in the right spots. So we have to basically repipe the heart to make it function. And that's how I would always kind of describe it to my nursing students. But I was like, don't tell that to cardiac surgeons because they don't It's a very expensive degree and a lot of training, but I'm like, they don't think it's
the
funny.
The first
as
person
funny
I heard
I do,
say that, but... Sandy, you're going to love this.
But
the
yeah.
The first person, I have a video of it. I can share it with you afterwards. The first person that I ever heard say that in an interview was Bill Norwood of the Norwood Operation. Said, the problem is.
Oh, I love that.
There you go. And that's like what I'm talking about. I'm like, the Norwood is a classic example of repiping the heart.
The problem is with the plumbing, and the people who fix the plumbing are surgeons. This is Bill Norwood's out of his mouth. So you're right up there with the giant, Sam. That's perfect.
Love it. Love it.
God, I should have just been a cardiac surgeon. Why did I go to nursing school?
That's a whole nother podcast.
But no, I think it's... No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm glad I chose what I did. But I think it's really interesting because we do. We have these adults before that now are living and they're thriving. Like, but they used to not live. So now it's like, okay, how do we manage this into now that they're going to come up into their 30s and so on and so forth? Because that is so new.
There was a really interesting presentation from a cardiologist who is actually studying those patients now. I'm sure you're probably familiar with some of the research in that, but it is interesting because it is a different population where these 30-year-olds are all surviving, you know, doing well or whatever, and requiring some sort of follow-up with their cardiologists, but we don't have a lot of information on them. So that is a really interesting point. And I know that's something that's, I'm assuming in cardiology, that's coming up for you.
Think of a couple of things just to share with you. Imagine, all right, it's great. I think it's fantastic. I have a patient now who is a fourth year with hypoplastic left heart syndrome, who is a fourth year medical student. He's going, so imagine he's a fourth year fellow. He's about to be a staff cardiologist. Imagine your doctor coming in and you're scared to death because your baby has HLHS. He goes, oh, I have that too.
Especially like that level of diagnosis. Yeah. Like I honestly kind of just got chills because that used to be such a death
sentence. If you were born before Prostin, your ducks. So there's nobody who was born before 1980. Yeah. So I was born in 56. If I was born with anything that needed the duct open, I would not be here. Right. So it was the medical advance of Prostin that was very similar to in the NICU population. If you were 33 weeks before surfactant, you died. So there was a huge difference as soon as surfactant came around. The younger generation takes for granted that the kid was surfed.
Right.
But that allows you to take care of these kids now. Right. Like there's so many wonderful stories. So there's, first of all, the other part about it is imagining being a 16-year-old with something that was fixed new, and you know there's nobody older than you with this. And before the internet, you thought you were the only person in the world with this. So there's support groups now and we're learning all that stuff. But if it's 1990 and you had your Norwood in 1984, you are scared to death. Your parents haven't let you do anything. You have become an obese Doritos eater, which isn't good for your Fontan either, right? So many things have changed because we didn't know that was going to be an issue. Until it happened. I have another young woman who's just wonderful with HLHS who just had her baby and her own baby. So now I can see my patients becoming parents and it's unbelievable. So again, the things that we thought were science fiction when I started are now, I can talk to you in Southern California and see you and share something with you. So what's going to be your generation science fiction? Yeah. Embrace that and see what it's going to be.
Because even some of these things that were such new advancements, we really do take for granted. We're like, okay, we're just going to do this kid's septostomy at the bedside and bring PGE with you to the delivery room. And like all those things are just stat echo. Like Dr. Ashrafi does his own echoes. At he just bedside. Pulls the machine out and is like, oh, all right. Like we just take all of that for granted as just like easy standard
great.
Of care.
Yeah. My hope is that I get to see all these people that I help train at whatever level. And I've been fortunate enough to the neonatology fellows and junior staff and critical care and cardiology and anesthesia and surgery and tons of nurses and to watch them get up on the stage and invent something new and do randomized trials. It's just the best, man. It absolutely is the best thing you can see. So I see a young, eager Dr. Ashrafi. He'll probably listen to this, but You know, he's sort of like a gold. He's like a golden.
Probably. Yes,
would it be fair to describe him as a golden retriever on a freshly waxed floor?
If there's a heart around.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
We always joke. Or
Cowboy.
Like, yeah. He, in the NICU, we would always joke like preemie, whatever. I'm not getting out of bed. HIE, my fellow can handle it. Blah, blah, blah. Like, da, da, da. We are like, hey, cardiac. He's like, I always joke. I'm like, instant, just like boner alert. He loves his cardiac.
But you know what? I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
We all do because it's, he also loved to teach it. Which is a very special.
I think that's why
place.
I like cardiac is my favorite. Like,
I love
you guys. I love you guys more and more.
I actually want to ask you.
You know, now that I hear you both love the cardiac kids, I'm just love you more.
Well, once you start hanging out with us, you might change your mind.
Yeah,
that's true. Skin. You got a tough skin. You're good. Was there a moment for you? This is like a weird question, but like throughout your career, was there a moment where you realized like you were the leader that you wanted
I'm not even sure I'm
or
there
like,
now.
Was there a moment for you? Yeah.
No. Short answer is no. It was not a light switch. It was more like a dimmer switch that you start to feel starting to feel that I am now of the older generation doesn't happen when you wake up and have a birthday. It's sort of, I think where I started to recognize it is when a large number of people that I helped train are now division chiefs and department heads and have sort of gone way beyond where I am. And they actually like thank me periodically, which is sort of cool. And they've gone much further than I ever did. That's when I feel that I've helped, you know, that I've done it. It's more. Yeah, that's right. They're all great. I get so emotional.
It's kind of a fun shift though.
But I think that's actually, so you mentioned one of the things about mentoring to you is like, you want to see someone you mentored up on stage because they develop some new treatment or intervention or procedure or something like that. But I feel like that's such a good segue into what you've done in the conference world, because that is like a huge, interesting thing that we want to get into because that really is setting the stage for that sharing of information and education and learning.
Where did this all start? Yeah. Let's start at square one, day one. How did you do this?
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple thousand dollars in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/affirmations or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/affirmations.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting.
It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively to Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
It starts with your first talk, all right? I'm a medical student, and I have to give a talk on the pancreas. I know you're excited. Who wouldn't be excited about a pancreas? So, and it's in the days of slides and, you know, projections and all stuff. And I'm giving my talk, and I'm talking about insulin and this. And then I show the microscopic slide, and I say, look, these are the islet cells. Look, they're all over the fucking place. And I keep talking, and I'm giving the whole talk. I have no idea I said that. None. And at the end, one of the medical students comes up and he goes, do you know what you said? And it was, I realized at that point, number one, that for me, fortunately, I was given a gift from God, whatever, that I'm very comfortable describing things. If I have a cue, I'm very bad at getting up and not having PowerPoint. So I liked at the beginning, I liked giving talks. And then I liked going to either a small room with 10 people and interacting like this. And then early in my career, I got to talk in front of big, large audiences. So then I really, it was 1998, and I was working at CHOP in Philly, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And I was invited to speak at a conference in Orlando in February. So, all right, imagine it's Philadelphia in February, and we all have the seasonal affective depression, and I'm tired of it. And I get out of the plane, and it's Florida in February. And I thought, this kind of makes a lot of sense, you know? And it was Arnold Palmer was doing a conference, and they invited me to be part of it. And then I got on the org. I weaseled my way into the organizing committee and then CHOP did it with them. And then we started a meeting in 1999, which is now known as the CHOP cardiology meeting, which started out with, 150 people. And it's now just had its 25th year. It's been taken over by Jack Rychick after I left CHOP and has taken it beyond to the next level. But it was fun because it gave me amnesia. And what that means is that the 6 months leading up to it are hell. And then you have this, it's like a baby. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you don't remember, I don't know, I've never had a baby, but you don't remember the labor. You don't remember the labor, but then you get this beautiful thing that comes out at the other end. Let's do it again. So we did it every year. And then it grew. And I've been involved in small ones with, you know, teaching to the pediatricians in the community, with running an ACHD meeting, that big interdisciplinary meeting, which was the first, I think, to have not just cardiologists, but nurses and surgeons. Because the reality is, for what you and I do, from what we do, if you don't have the whole team there, it doesn't really work as well. So then, as I think you know, and if you don't mind me talking about what's coming up, I'd be happy to do that. But the
no, please,
we're excited. Yeah.
I'm glad so you excited. Are, because in the next eight weeks, it's going to be a little crazy. But so there's this thing.
We're not the pregnant ones. We're just like, we're like auntie and uncle that just get to be like, oh, cute baby.
And
oh
then
my gosh.
Share it with social media and help be like, let's go together.
Look at our new niece and nephew.
They're
yay.
So cute. Yeah.
But we're not the pregnant one.
Or while you're pregnant, the 2-year-old toddler pulling on your pants. Hey, come change my diaper.
There you go.
So this comes back to 2009. All right. Everything's got, you know, you should have invited me. You shouldn't have invited me for only an hour. So this is because the reason why I'm doing
the
World
Congress
is
because
of the Philadelphia Eagles. So you're going to have to give me a little bit. There is a connection here. So in 2009, the Eagles were in the NFC Championship game against the Cardinals. And I had a connection to get Super Bowl tickets. The Super Bowl was in Tampa. And I'm sure I'm going to see the Eagles in the Super Bowl. And I'm on call in the CICU at CHOP, and I watch their quarterback just throw a bomb to Larry Fitzgerald, and we lose the game. But I still have Super Bowl tickets. So I go to the Super Bowl with my friend Jeff Jacobs, and he turns to me, and because we had run meetings together in Florida, he goes, why don't we try to bring the World Congress to the United States? It's never been here. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. Now, had the Eagles won that game?
How many beers did you guys have at that
point? Yeah, how many drinks did we have at that point?
It's a whole nother. We told Jeff he had a transplant. We planted his nurse coordinator for the transplant team to say he had a transplant at the first quarter and he had to leave. And so he's like, oh, shit. And he throws his beer in the trash. And that's another podcast.
But had the Eagles won, I had
that conversation, I would have been cheering and all that. There's all these things that happen. That's the butterfly effect, right? So anyway, we decide to do that. We get the bid. We get 30 children's hospitals to give us some startup money. We make a proposal. We go visit 3 cities. We decide Washington is the best place in the United States to hold the conference. We have a group called Destination DC, which has just been incredible. 3 airports to come in. It's a very metropolitan international city. So we say, this is the place to be. And we go to Prague in 2014 and we win the bid for the United States. I thought that was a good thing. No, it is a good thing. The World Congress, just as a little background for your listeners, the World Congress is, since in 1980, there was a World Congress for Pediatric Cardiology, and then it happened again in 85. And then in 89, there was a World Congress for Cardiac Surgery. And then they decided, oh, let's put it together in 1993, and it was cardiologists and surgeons. And that was the first World Congress was in 1993. Do you know what happened the year before that, team? The internet. It's not a coincidence, right? So people started to get, you realized you could go over to Paris, which is where it was, and you could share abstracts electronically. It opened up, that opened up conferences, quite frankly, when that happened in 93. And so then it's gone around. It's been in Paris. It's been in Cape Town, South Africa. It's been in Buenos Aires, been in Barcelona. It hasn't been in the United States as a combined, hold on one second, as a combined meeting. It hasn't been in the United States as a combined meeting ever. So for the first time in 38 years, people in the United States, North America, the world, but certainly us, have a chance to see a once in a lifetime event that has, as of today, 3,200 registrants, 1,600 abstracts. We think we'll get to 4,500 people from all over the world. We have people from 101 countries registered. So you can hear a talk about transplants in Tehran, Iran. You can hear a talk about how they deal with authority gradients in Sydney. You don't get that opportunity to have an international faculty. So it's a large meeting. It's got a lot of, I was going to say the one last thing. It was supposed to be in 2021, but COVID. So we had this planned in 2021, and now it's like having a wedding, getting divorced and having another wedding, I guess. I've never been divorced, but so we're ready to go, but it's just a massive affair. It's a massive affair.
Yeah, we're thrilled. I'm so excited. And I wanted to give a shout out to this for all the nurses and the RTs. It's the Saturday before, and Sunday. Is that correct? Is when they're having the symposium, and Sunday specifically for the nursing staff. So, and there's a lot of really great topics. That is what I'm aiming to get there early for that specifically. Sam and I are very excited. I've been so thrilled about this, and it's fun because I happen to work in a university that is very excited to be a part of this as well. And so I don't know if I think this is a huge opportunity for all NICU, CVICU, RTs, nurses, anyone who works in those facilities, NPs, NNPs, PAs, everyone. This is a huge, huge opportunity that everyone should take advantage of if you can. Get the time off.
Well,
now.
No, I just have to even appreciate the fact that nursing is included, and not just included, as in you can attend, but truly embraced in that way. Because I think a lot of things when it comes to conference worlds, even for neonatology and stuff, there's NAN, which is NICU Nurses, Neonatal Nurses Association. And then there's other things that are specific to neonatologists, and you don't get so much crossover. But truly, back to the beginning part of this interview with you, was talking about how multidisciplinary it takes to be in an ICU setting. And so I don't know. I just really respect the fact that you guys have made this such a multidisciplinary affair.
How can we do it any other way? We want progress, but I said it many times. We want progress, but we're resistant to change. NAN rarely has doctors at it. The American College of Cardiology rarely has nurses at it.
Yes.
And if they have nurses, they're in the corner rooms over there not working. And that's not how we work. That's not how we work every day. It's not how we give the best care for patients. So we have parents that are speaking. So it's the 8th World Congress of Pediatric Cardiology. Patients too speaking. So 8th World Congress, Pediatric Cardiology, Cardiac Surgery. It's August 27th with a pre-conference day to September 1st. It ends on Labor Day. The only good, not the only good thing, but one of the good things happened because of COVID was that they were dying to get hotels opened again. So when they gave us our hotel rooms, we got incredibly cheap hotel rooms. So it's like $200 in Washington, D.C. on the Labor Day weekend. That just doesn't happen. The one thing I do want to emphasize is that many meetings are, you go for a couple of days and you come back. This is an investment. This is an investment in your career. It's a week long. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to get the time out, or you can leave early, but it's a week long. It's priced because it's a week long. And it's the one time in your life you get to be with people from around the world in a multidisciplinary meeting that has your, and whoever's listening to this, your, you could be an anesthesiologist, you could be a nurse, you could be a staff cardiologist, a person who does MRI, or somebody who does stem cells. There's something for everybody here, top to bottom. And I hope that people realize how special this is and take advantage of it. So it's a 5-day meeting. It's priced for staff physicians higher than for everybody else. So nurses, fellows in training, PhDs, anyone else who wants to come. It's now the I feel like an announcer now that I have my microphone. Take advantage of the early bird rates, which end on July 14th. You are the first people to learn today that the early bird rates were extended to July 14th. So they'll go up about $100, $200 for staff physicians in 2 weeks. And it takes that long to make plane reservations and everything else. So I hope that people come.
Well, and the 2-day academy you can buy separately for the nurses if you're a local and you want to hit it up. The other thing I want to say is if Sam and I could swing it, you know, we would love to go out and maybe do like a meet and greet, maybe go to dinner somewhere if we can swing this. So we will definitely, this is something that we have intention to go to. And I'm so excited for this skill. Like, I think that this is remarkable. Wait, can I also circle back to this? I really have to know.
Oh, yeah. CVICU, but before I get to that, we got to circle back. Having seen these reels? Having seen these reels that you do, I expect you to be like,
yeah,
all around the World Congress and just showing everybody, oh, look, there's.
There we go. Let's do this. Oh, I can't wait. I was just thinking of like, okay, content wise, what can we start making and sharing? You know, I just. It's just really exciting. And I also love your passion. Are you speaking
a couple times, but I've got too much to do. But I do want to say one thing for everybody that comes.
I know you're running the show.
It's a price one has to pay. There's an anatomy lab that is, you start on this side and you see specimens.
Oh, cool.
Then you see how that specimen looked, real hearts, right? Then you go over here and you see what it looks like on an echo or an angio. And then you go over here and you put on virtual reality and you can walk your way through it. And then you can pick up a 3D heart that shows tetralogy.
That's right.
So as many times as we draw, like Amir will draw on the whiteboard, there is something very different in 3D holding the heart and saying, now I got it. This has never existed before, ever. This was our idea. So that is a huge piece of content that I expect you to be doing reels in. Like, hi. Look, I have tetralogy right here. Tori.
Oh my God, let's
just
do it.
In my hand.
I can't wait. All this AI and everything that's going on. Like, you know what's interesting, and I love that you brought this up, is I'm always surprised in our medical field. I feel like we are so freaking resistant to change. Mm-hmm. And why aren't we more progressive in ways like this? I agree. And I think this is amazing. And it's crazy that this is the first time, but here we are. And, you know, I think that you're just leading in that way of like, hey, these are the things that are happening and showing people and like bringing people together. Like, this is what fires me up is these kinds of things, because I don't know, having been to NeoHeart now twice, those were some of the best experiences I ever had. And I would imagine this one's going to be exponentially even better just because it's so much on a bigger level in terms of people from around the world. And I don't know. I'm really excited. This is the kind of thing that gets me up. And I know it's an investment. But
I do want to give NeoHeart a shout out. They're very forward thinking. They always have been. It's not my silo of neonatology and not my silo of pediatric cardiology and not my silo of cardiac surgery and not my silo of bedside nursing and not my silo of advanced practice nursing. All of those people come together for babies with heart disease. We should not work in silos. And they are very forward thinking. And
right.
We did a little bit of a bad. I did a little bit of a bad job on the marketing of this because we emphasized that this was a unique track of the World Congress, and many people in your field, when they read the way we promoted it, didn't think the meeting was for them. We had faculty say, "Why am I getting an invitation to this? I don't go to that meeting." So we're trying to do a pivot that this is neonatal cardiology. but international neonatal cardiology. Right.
Mm. Yeah. No, it is funny because it's how important branding and thinking about those things actually is. And it's such a, you know, it's a learning curve, right? Mm-hmm. You learn and you pivot and you figure it out. And no, you're doing a wonderful job. And, you know, things like today, this is, you know, getting you behind the mic and hearing this. Yeah. Like, I just think this is so valuable to hear from the founder of this amazing thing. I mean,
There's another experience. I love slogan because they stick around for a while because they actually mean something. And one is good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So I'm at the other end of that curve, but you have to learn from the bad judgment. And now we know how to market to the audience. You can't do it the way I did it. So hopefully we'll be able to get enough neonatologists, especially through the help you're giving us. So I can't thank you enough for exposing this out there.
Yeah. Spicing up the Instagram. Well, you know, what's interesting too, is I just think, like, where's your audience? You know, and I know my audience, right? They're on Instagram, they're on TikTok, they're on those platforms. And I think medical thinks they're not supposed to be there. And in my head, I'm like, no. Like, you are supposed to be there. That is where everyone is, right? And so it's just learning about, maybe that's a part of the shifting, right? Shifting for us in medical is like learning how to reach everyone that you want to reach. And
until it's your generation running meetings, right? And what I've learned from your generation and my kids and whatnot. But, you know, the senior people that are running this meeting want to talk about brochures through postal mail, and they want to talk about email blasts. And okay, it's not an or, it's an and. Like, if you rely just on that and don't take advantage of Twitter Med and all the things, you know, a hell of a lot better than me. I hope that there'll be some hashtagging. That's such a cool word. I hope that there will be some hashtagging going on. I know we have some hashtags and stuff like that, so I'm counting on you too.
Yeah. It's on the Instagram too. And we will link the Instagram as well as website and everything, of course, in the show notes. Cool. So everything is going to be there for everybody.
All right. You want to hear the dark side of cardiac intensive care?
Yes.
Selfie unpopular opinion.
Yeah, give us the unpopular opinion.
We didn't ask him. We didn't ask you what your unpopular opinion
was.
We're
doing this backwards.
Yeah, you can close us out with
unpopular opinion. There you go. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of, do you know what dialectical thinking is? Is holding two seemingly opposite views at the same time as true. That is the notion of that's an and. That's when something is an and. I wish that we had changed the way we marketed I wish the way we marketed neonatology better, and now we're doing a better job. Both are true.
Okay. Love
So that's dialectical thinking. So I have a pretty good view, I think, of the brilliance of cardiac intensive care and the dark side, the Darth Vader of cardiac intensive care. So it comes back to you have to know the history behind this about why it happened. So in the 80s, when prostaglandin was now sort of new, echo was around, Dr. Norwood had designed the Norwood procedure. Dr. Castaneda started doing neonatal arterial switches. I was doing 36 hours in a row. This was all happening at the same time. The surgeons realized we were in a surgical ICU. That's the way it was set up in Boston. It was 18 beds, and 9 beds were general surgery and 9 beds were cardiac surgery. And the nursing staff floated, but there were two different care teams. And there was a bed space with I think a congenital diaphragmatic hernia or some baby on oscillator or whatever we had at the time. And Dr. Norwood had a patient he needed to operate on, and he literally unplugged the kid and say, this kid's going to the other side of the unit. My patient goes here. Can't do that shit anymore. But that's what happened. But clearly what happened was cardiac intensive care was set up pure and simple for the surgeon's benefit. We talk about it now as subspecializing in this and all this, and we have revisionist history. This was purely done for the surgeons so they could cohort them. The byproduct of that was the nurses got very skilled and getting a spidey sense of when something's not right. We didn't have the monitoring we had right now. The best monitor is a bedside nurse. Mm-hmm. And then all the neonatal stuff was put there. And we realized we learned a lot about taking care of neonates, term, with heart disease. In the same place came a six-year-old having her atrial septal defect close or a conduit chain. And we sort of said, well, that's what cardiac intensive care was. It was all cardiologists, not intensivists, who like taking care of critically ill kids. That's what a cardiac intensivist is. It's not what training path you have. You devote your career to critically ill patients with congenital or acquired heart disease. That's what it is. And the PICUs hated us because once we said there was good friends of mine now, but it was some of the people at CHOC. What are we going to have next? A big toe intensive care? You know, we can take care of everything. So
it's.
Yeah, of course it is.
It's still a thing. PICU versus CVICU versus NICU. It's still a thing. Okay.
Well, and I think actually the structure of some children's hospitals of where they send their pre-op parts, because some pre-op is NICU, post-op is CVICU until the rest of their life. But some hospitals, pre-op is CVICU. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the PICU, NICU.
It's definitely a dynamic.
Or the PICU, CVICU, because they used to not have them separate. There's turf wars.
We all
there's
want progress, but we're resistant to change. Maybe that's what we should call the podcast.
Well, boom.
Can I drop?
You know what? You need your own podcast.
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
Drop the mic.
No, he's like, no, that was. He's like, I need this mic.
We learned a ton. But there's always unintended consequences. So I would say the first unintended consequence was neonatology trainees stopped seeing kids with cardiac disease. So now there are many attendings who really don't have the grasp of complex resistance, pressure, ductus, ASD, let alone complex congenital heart disease. No fault of their own.
I've loved this is because I have made intention. I float over to CVICU often.
Well, you did critical care float pool.
I did critical care float pool. I love CVICU and it is very closely linked to NICU, but you're right. It is a specialty.
You can't
right?
dabble.
So it's like it takes time and a lot of extra effort on your part.
No.
It's like you have to really be engaged.
You couldn't dabble in taking care of a micro preemie. Yeah. Like, oh, I work on the floor, but let me take care of this 450 grammar. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work that way, right? So the equal downs, the same thing happened with PICU attendance. Okay. The next dark side of this is that research that's done in cardiac units is not relevant to half of the pediatric ICUs in the country because they're mixed units. So the stuff that comes out of my unit is relevant to people who have units set up like mine, but not my unit in particular. Next dark side is we have these different care models of NICU, OR, CI. Worst thing that could ever have been invented, in my opinion. So the three handoffs on the most dangerous day of a baby's life, and the family learns a whole new care team. Whoever thought that was a good idea, right? So there's
You're
that.
Right.
There's the fact that if you have a mixed unit, there might not be the experience with recognizing tamponade the same way it might be. There's things that have been lost in the current generation of attendings now by us separating the units 20 years ago. Research is different. So there's a good side of this and a bad side of this. So
I love that you're going into
we
that.
We specialize to a fault sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting because just last week I had a situation where I had a baby who was going to surgery literally the next morning and no one had taken them over to the other unit where they were going to post-op. So I love that you bring that up because you're right. Like, it's those little details where it's so overwhelming for these families. And yes, is it just a walk down the hall? But like, I literally took them over there and said, okay, this is where you're going to be going. This is the side of unit you're going to be on and you're going to be seeing this staff
for the rest of their life.
Right. But like, I can't, it was on me to do that because
I have a short-term solution. I have a short-term solution and an unpopular solution. So Sam, when you said we specialize to a fault, I think we can be a little, well, I think we can be a little too hard on ourselves. Everything we do has unintended consequences. It's not like we're trying to have that happen. We're trying to do the best we can. And once we start recognizing what the unintended consequences are, we can start to make a difference in that. So for example, I don't work at your place. I may piss off people at your place, but to me, you get transferred to the recovery. You get transferred to the CICU 2 days before your operation. The parents then meet the team. They're not meeting a new team with an incision and an open chest, but all solutions are local. That's not what I want to talk about.
Right.
So here's my unpopular solution that I've debated at various societies and has made me a little bit of my job at my point in my career. My point in my career is I stir the pot. I like stirring the pot because if you don't think, and this is the way, like you said, this is the way we've always done it.
Selfie energy. There.
So if I had to do it all over again, so I was one of the founding members of the Cardiac ICU Society, one of the first cardiac intensive care units. I would eliminate cardiac intensive care units. Pause. I would eliminate cardiac intensive care units. So if I was building a hospital from scratch, I would eliminate them and I would still have cardiac intensivists. So here's what I would do. I had unlimited ATM and I was building a brand new model. First of all, I wouldn't do it in a children's hospital because what's happening with adult congenital heart disease is you go to a new hospital, a different medical record, a different ecosystem, a different group of people. When you're 24 in my unit, I don't know what to do with someone Zoloft. You know, and there's somebody in my hospital right now. There's nobody in my children's hospital who deals with adult issues. But if you're part of, let's say, Duke, right, or Inova, which is near us, where you go down the hallway and find somebody who can come over. I can't get a psychologist for my patient's parents because every psychologist in my place chose to be a pediatric psychologist. And even though the parents need it and we want to get them help at the most stressful time of their lives, we can't do it because we're an independent children's hospital. There's many benefits and unintended consequences of being in the children's hospital. So what I would do is I would make a unit for prematology. That is a different disease than full-term babies with critical stuff, right? So what is done, the neonatology, to somebody, I could walk into your unit and help take care of any term kid, a congenital diaphragmatic hernia or an omphalocele or HIE or that stuff I get. But tell me what to do with 700 grams of a baby. I have no clue. So you'd have a prematology unit. Then I would have a critically ill neonatal unit, non-term, not premature. So CDH, HIE, omphalocele, newborn sepsis, congenital heart disease. We would all learn from each other.
Surgical,
right? So the neuro kids, the neurology that we would learn in neonatal neurology would be very applicable to the cardiac population. How the blood goes around in a kid with pulmonary, how the blood hypoxic, goes around a CDH baby. Amir gave a great talk on this, that a duct dependent lesion. Mm-hmm. What do you do when the ductus reverses its flow? How fast do you wean the nitric oxide? We would learn from each other. In that setting, every PICU can take care of a child that comes in 2 months old after tetralogy repair. Good PICU, cardiology consultation, surgical consultation. Those kids are going to do absolutely fine. So I would have four units, and the fourth unit would be the graduates from all of those units that need chronic critical care. Because right now,
Your DOU, so it's not quite PEDS floor, but it's like a 1-to-1 or it's a 2-to-1.
It's the PICU step down.
It's your PICU step down.
Chronic critical care.
Yeah.
What we do now is we shoehorn them into the model we currently have. Mm-hmm. But design it from scratch. Who wants to work there? What should the personnel strategy be, et cetera, et cetera. So I would build four units and then the adult congenital unit would be in the other place.
Very smart.
Could not agree
but
more.
But we all want... It won't happen, but that's what I would say.
Because, because people are resistant to change.
Is, you know, I work at a university center, so kind of along the lines of where you are, minus the pre. But what's interesting is they didn't think about the things that I love that you brought this up in terms of the the higher level kids who are more the chronic, right? So they're the post-ops, are going to a peds floor on a section of that floor, but they're really not, there's still higher level of care and it's burning the nurses out. And they're not thinking about the things that you're, you know, I was trying to call over to a fellow the other night and he was kind of irritated because he had to come over and like, so the work.
Did you tell him it's not
really
about
not
you? You have to tell him it's not about you.
Down, and that's what causes.
It's not about you.
So, but it's great because, no, I love that you're bringing this up because I think it's like we do need to start thinking out of the box. We need to start working as a team. People are burned out. We got to figure out how to get to the core of it. And I like, you know, you're talking about the full picture, right? Because it does take a team. It takes all of us. And having that dynamic thinking, hopefully down the line, someone will hear this and be like, we should redesign this or mm-hmm. we should rethink this. How are we doing this? Or can we staff this a little differently? Or can we teach this a little differently? Or can we bring on someone who's better at this?
Well,
than
there's two kinds
you know,
of people.
Stuff like that. This is why we love you.
There are the yes if people and the no because people. We fall into one of those categories. Mm-hmm. You all know the person who you have a great idea and they say no because X, Y, Z, whatever it might be. There's other right. people. Yeah, we could do that. We need $40,000 and we need 22 people. They make it positive as opposed to we don't have that money. Say, yeah, we can do that. Let's figure out a way to,
right.
it solves problems mm-hmm. completely differently. I don't know any hospital right now that could basically stop operations to make that happen. Because that's what you'd have to do, right?
Yeah.
You could do it.
You have to
you could do it. And you'd have
new...
to get buy-in by three ICU directors. And, you know, what stops all these new ideas in their track in academic medicine is ego, space. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. Right. And just call it out what it is.
Well, people don't want to give up ownership to things.
They work.
I mean, we get
Sam, they work for that.
That are about to turn 1 year old and they don't want to transfer them to PICU. It's like, this is not a neonate anymore. Give it up.
Yeah. Like,
give
it
a rest.
To go,
it's
like,
PICU time.
I'm maxed
stop.
Out on everything. You got, yes.
We
exactly.
can't
yes.
stop having this damn near toddler in neonate.
All right. So, repeat after me. We all want progress.
Come on. What?
But we're resistant to change. But
we
were
progress.
Resistant to change. Okay.
Resistant to
but
change.
We're resistant to change. Yes.
But I think one of the best things that I think Tori and I align on this, we are the yes, we can make this happen. We need X, Y, Z. Because I'd never look at something to be like, nope, that's not possible. I'm like, all right, how
good
can I
you.
Make this
good.
Work?
You yeah. want to come work in Washington? Come work in Washington. The all right, can I tie it up no. with one more story? So we've
yes.
been talking about
yes,
music
please.
And medicine and how one thing leads to another and you never know where it's going to go and all the rest of it. So I'm in Philadelphia and we're doing morning rounds. And I don't know, so we have a PICU fellow and cardiology fellow and usual staff. And I said, what I was talking about before, I said, you know, one of the things that you can notice as we do all this care is that surgeons are like classical musicians. They repeat and repeat and repeat and do it the same way and focus. And the surgical outcomes happen because they're more like classical musicians. But those of us who work in here are more like jazz musicians. Like what I said before, you know, you hear what's going on around you, you work as a group, you respond to people. And after rounds, a critical care fellow, her name's Vanessa, came up to me. Are you a musician? What? Like, why did you say that? I'm like, well, I am. I'm a pianist. She goes, oh, I used to sing in clubs in Miami. So, oh, really? What do you like to sing? There's a few things. So we went, I have an electronic piano in my office and she came up post-call and sang a Stan Getz song called Corcovado in perfect Portuguese. We became great friends. And we have a band called the Baby Blue Sound Collective, which is all pediatric cardiologists and heart surgeons from around the world. We show, you can look us up on, if you look us up on the iTunes, you'll find Baby Blue Sound Collective. We have two albums, but it's all pediatric cardiology, cardiac surgery. We're not bad. We're okay. So she wanted, we were the Blue Baby Sound Collective, but the parent groups didn't like us calling it the Blue Baby Sound Collective. So it's the Baby Blue Sound Collective. And I had my nephew who was not a doctor or nurse. He's a IT guy, but he's a phenomenal sax player. So we had him join us. He was our ringer. So Vanessa comes and joins us. She's a great singer and they get to know each other. And then he's going out with someone and she's not and vice. Like, I don't know any of this. I'm totally clueless that they're like, anyway, they finally get to the point that they become boyfriend and girlfriend. Then they got married. Now they have two kids. And she said to me, you know, I used to call you Dr. Ranofsky, but now you're Uncle Gil. So you, right?
Oh,
so if I didn't say that one thing on rounds while this particular fellow was there at that particular day, they would not be married and I wouldn't have a niece and a nephew by then. How do these things happen, right?
The coolest.
So, you know, I'm not going to get too spiritual on you, but I know that you and I are talking on this podcast. Something will happen because of this. And it'll be for the good. Yeah. It's just the way this, it's pay it forward. That's just the way this works.
God, I just love you. I need like a little Gil in my pocket.
No, you don't. I have a.
Yes, we do. This is the kind of energy we like.
We all have a dark side. You know that. Even cardiac intensive care.
We do, but we need like Gil's 10 rules to live by from Gil.
There are a couple commandments. Reminder.
Yeah.
Commandments.
Yeah, they're not
we
rules.
Like those
they're,
commandments.
They're commandments.
We need a list of those.
But that'll be for the next one.
Okay. I like that. That's more firm.
All right. Just a text.
Well, thank you.
It's been my pleasure, both of you. Sam, it's nice to meet you virtually. And I look forward to seeing both of you in Washington, D.C. on August 27th through September 1st, Labor Day weekend, 2023.
Wow, you have a good.
Deeply discounted room rates.
Movie you voice. Do.
Invest a week in your career. It'll last a lifetime.
Oh my gosh.
Here we go.
You have movie preview
really
voice.
He does. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I was about to say podcast like, voice, no, but this is like preview, movie
like,
preview.
In a world where two people collide. Like
picture, if you will, a time where there is no.
Good.
It's also been said that I have a face. I have a face for audio. So it's good.
There's a reason we do a podcast.
Hardly.
Yeah, we know.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
we're so excited.
Thank
and
you.
Today was so much
as
fun.
Am I.
Yeah,
as
you
am
are
I.
A treasure. Okay, well, we're officially going.
We are.
And I hope you're there because who does not want to be part of this?
We are so excited. If you do decide to come, you guys, send us a DM and Sam and I will try and connect with you. Sam will be officially working the event just because she is going to be going with her company, but we will do our best to try and meet up with you guys, say hi. We are thrilled to be going to this. And I haven't been to DC in so long.
I went a year ago, but it was for a funeral. So it wasn't like
yeah,
it was I didn't.
Different.
Yes, very different. So I'm really excited because it was a cool city, but I didn't do anything in the city. So I'm really excited to come back.
Yeah, we're thrilled to come over to the East Coast and maybe meet some of you guys.
And everything to do with hearts. Like, that's my jam. I nerd out on this stuff.
This is going to be, it's so interesting because, you know, as Gil said, this is an investment. And that's how we're both seeing this, you know, with our time. It's an investment, but also fun and something, you know, that we wouldn't normally, you know, get or be able to do. But let's go. Let's all go together. We hope to see you guys there.
Yes.
Can't wait.
Link in bio.
Absolutely. And make sure you guys are following us as always. Make sure you head over to our IG. That's at @CELLFIE_podcast. You can find all of our goodies linked there in the bio.
And please thank you for all your reviews. If you drop a 5-star review on Spotify or leave an IG review with your IG. No, I can't talk. Podcast review on Apple.
Love that.
Drop your IG handle. Free stickers. Yay. Who doesn't love that?
Absolutely. And make sure you're following us on our Insta. That's @NurseTori.
And @HeySamantha with 2 A's. And it'll probably be about a week or so until you hear from us. We're just kind of sorting some stuff out.
Yep.
But stay tuned.
Yeah. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
All right, you guys.
Bye.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting.
It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively the Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.